Our guest today is one of the most recognised and recognisable men in Australia. He's very much a self-made man. He saw the future of electronics and formed his own empire. That done and sold off, he was free to let his spirit soar. That has taken him across the continent and the Tasman in a balloon and around the world and over the North Pole in a helicopter. In all of these things, he was first. In 1986, he founded Australian Geographic and fought for the Australian environment. Now he runs his own food company, fighting to bring Australian ownership back to our supermarket shelves. But there's another serious side to our speaker, the fighter for safety in Australian skies. And this took him to chairmanship of the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, where his views were often in conflict with others. But our speaker has never shirked conflict when he believes he is right. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dick Smith.
Thank you very much. I'd much rather be talking here about something that I've been successful at, which is Dick Smith Foods. By the way, that's peanut butter. And I have probably about one box of famous dickhead matches, which they're very rare, but I'd much rather be talking about Dick Smith Foods. We've sold over $8 million worth in 2.5 months. Just shows you how Aussies... Yep. Aussies support having a balance, a fair balance in our food industry. But I'm going to talk mostly about something that I failed at. But it is important for everyone who's here that we have safe skies, and we're in terrible problems at the moment. Beside me here are the reports on the major accidents, which all have a ring of similarity amongst them. This is the accident with originally Advance 20 years ago, 13 passengers in a King Air, all single pilot, small size aircraft, 9 passengers or below normally, that have got into problems. And I'm going to tell you in 20 minutes, 25 minutes, how I tried to do something to fix this problem so we didn't have more, and how I failed. First of all, I think it was my worst nightmare when the Whyalla Airlines plane crashed, because Whyalla Airlines flies on one of the few routes in Australia which has an airline standard, safety standard aircraft flying on the same route, which of course is the Kendall plane. And I'll mention a little bit later the differences in these safety standards which have been forced on us by society and affordable safety. Of course, as you probably know, you can fly to Whyalla in a 9-passenger plane with one pilot, or you can fly in a full airline standard aircraft. And I'm interested in knowing whether those people knew that there was an alternative. And I also, when that plane crashed, I said to myself, if I'd been successful in the reforms that I tried to bring in, would have we been able to save that crash? And maybe we could have. To me, it was a repeat almost of the Seaview nightmare, where in this particular case, a father, John Laverick, had taken his daughter and her husband, they're a honeymoon couple, off the Qantas plane which flies to Lord Howe Island. It's a full airline standard plane, 2 pilots, single engine accountability. Take them off and put them onto a single pilot, small aircraft, which doesn't have to comply with the same safety standards. And the plane, the Seaview plane, crashed. And of course, he said at the time, well, he didn't know there was a totally different regulated level of safety. Now, also, the reason I came out and spoke very quickly is for one reason only. I don't want any other people to die unnecessarily. And I'd been very much involved with Whyalla Airlines. In December 97, when I wasn't even chairman, I was acting chairman of CASA, a report came across to the board which had enough information on the report that gave the board the impression that this could be another Seaview, Monarch or Advance. And these are companies which, at least in writing, don't comply over a period of time with regulations and then ending up with a crash. And aviation is not perfectly safe, but what is unacceptable to the public, I'm sure, is that if an airline crashes and you end up with, say, a $20 million inquiry into Seaview, and you find that for years the airline either didn't have the management expertise or the money to comply with the regulations. And it's interesting because it's not just whether a person who runs an airline wants to comply with the regulations or not. It's whether they have the skills to do so and whether they have the money to do so. In Australia, we're the only country in the world that allows a 9-passenger and below single-pilot aircraft, which is not certified even to maintain height on one engine, to be called an airline. And, of course, not only do we call them airlines, but then we give them the most onerous paperwork that is almost possible to understand. If you get into a chieftain in the United States, in New Zealand or in Canada, it's called an air taxi operator. And it can have a scheduled service, can have a program of flights exactly like Qantas can, but they don't kid anyone. It's a small plane. It doesn't comply with the incredibly onerous paperwork requirements of an airline. It's quite different here, of course. In Australia, these small operators, and there's not a lot of them, are given such extraordinarily ridiculous requirements, and I'll try to tell you some soon, that there's simply no way they can spend the limited amount of money they have on what's important for safety. Now, our board was quite a different board. What normally happens with a board of the Civil Aviation Safety Authority is the bureaucracy makes sure they get people there who know nothing about aviation, for obvious reasons. But once you get a board who knows something about aviation, you get a board that can tackle the problems like this and say, hey, we've got to think laterally. If we're continually having similar accidents, we've got to do something which is worthwhile. Now, we wanted to fix the problem because after $20 million in the inquiry into Seaview, when our board was there, under about a year after we got in, Aquatic Airlines, a little seaplane operator in Sydney Airport, crashed at Barara, killing 5 people, and it came out very quickly that it was an operator which once again didn't comply with regulations over many years. And the lateral thinking board said, what can we do something about this? And it was interesting because it became very apparent, and quite apparent if you read these reports, that there's no proper enforcement system in place. There's simply, if you go speeding, you get a fine, don't you? Well, I can tell you now that the airlines have never, ever received a fine from CASA. And that's very, very important. Now, at the time when we got this report on Whyalla Airlines, I spoke to Kim Brum, who's here today. And I think he rang me, or I rang him, or I think it might have been the local member of parliament who rang me and said, look, he's a good operator, he's a good bloke, and CASA are trying to take action against him. So I spoke to Kim, and he was absolutely convinced that a vendetta was against him. He told me how he'd started off in aviation. His father was involved in aviation, of course, and that he'd got his flying licence and his helicopter licence, and then he'd started operating a charter carrier, and then he'd moved up into airline operations, the highest you can get in Australia, a scheduled service. It's the highest safety standard. He told me about his continuing problems with CASA, he said they basically harassed him the whole time. This was the organisation I was the deputy chairman of. And he said, basically, every time there's an accident, they come up with more paperwork, but they don't fix any of the problems. And I was very concerned because I thought, well, I'm being told at our level that there's real problems with Whyalla Airlines. It's a non-compliant operator. And naturally, as a board, the last thing we want to happen is another Monarch or Seaview, where a company that has a history of non-compliance ends up killing people. So the board agreed that we'd do some major changes. There were 4 major changes, and they were, first of all, that we would move to have one standard for all 9-passenger and below aircraft. Pretty logical. It was recommended by the Seaview Commission, $20 million I'll mention again spent, and it said, to have 2 aeroplanes sitting at an airport, one a chieftain, which is on a charter flight that you've chartered, to have it operating to a completely different standard to another chieftain which had a scheduled service is impossible for anyone to understand. And of course, what happened with Kim is different times they'd have to swap planes around and they'd say the plane that is supposed to be for the scheduled service is a charter plane. Now, you and I can't tell the difference, but if you're a CASA regulator, you're going to be... We won't be fined, but we'll take action against your air operator certificate because we have different standards. So the board said, we will have one standard. We will follow the international standard. We'll call it air taxi, and it will be one standard that these people can afford to maintain. Only 9 passengers normally on board the aeroplane. Not a lot of money for safety. Not as much as when you have 400 passengers on a jumbo jet. And remember, all the money for safety comes from the passenger ticket. Nowhere else. So, let's move on. The next point was that we wanted to allocate substantial resources to safety education of people like Kim Brown. $70 million is the fund of CASA. And when I asked him, I said, how often have you had someone down there giving you an education program like they do overseas? He said, never. And so our decision at the board was, well, we'll spend about a third, about $20 million in safety education to these regular public transport operators and charter operators and the commercial people who are getting the job. Well, then thirdly, we'll introduce a proper enforcement system. There was none. A system where you can fine someone, they can go to court and not pay the fine, or they pay the fine. The next thing we would do is communicate to the public the different levels of safety that are regulated between 9 passenger planes and 20 to 30 passenger planes and above. We would do those 4 things. Now, I've got to tell you now that 3 of them we completely failed at. The 4th one we temporarily succeeded and then we failed at it. And so as of today, none of those things have been solved, and I want to tell you why. First of all, let me get on to the one standard for all aircraft that are 9 passengers or less. At the present time, there's 2 standards. If one goes on a scheduled service and publishes a timetable, he has a completely different standard. By the way, I think it actually ends up less safe, because the paperwork that they have to do is the same paperwork that Qantas has to do. And let me explain to you. Imagine if you rush out to the airport at Qantas and you manage to get on, you're the last person to get on. Well, that goes into the computer. The weight and balance, which checks that aircraft, as if one person would make a lot of difference, it wouldn't. But that's done by the computer immediately, because a company like Qantas has billions of dollars to spend. Well, can you imagine this? If you have a little Navajo and you get out to Burke Aerodrome, and suddenly another passenger appears. Now, if it's under the charter category, the pilot can sensibly say, I'm way under gross weight, I know this aeroplane perfectly. If he sits in the centre of the wing, it's within centre of gravity and it's under the gross weight. But if it moves on to the airline category, in other words, you've published a regular schedule, oh no, it must come under the Qantas requirements. So that means the pilot, well, he hasn't got a computer, has he? So he has to sit there in the rain calculating his weight and balance. And if he doesn't correctly, even though he knows it's within, and he makes a mathematical error, when CASA does a surveillance, they will check the mathematical errors and then write to Kim Brown, which they did, and say, the mathematical errors are wrong. That is a non-compliance notice for you. And anyone with any brains would look at it and say, but what does that have to do with safety? Nothing. So what I'm trying to explain to you is we have a system which has these 2 quite false different standards that's all dependent on paperwork, more and more paperwork. Well, I thought we should do something about this, and so I called a meeting. I was accused of being hands-on, but if you weren't hands-on, nothing happened. These reports just kept coming out. The Bureau of Air Safety Investigation never makes a recommendation that says bring in a proper enforcement system or have one standard, nothing like that. It's do more reports, do more paperwork. It's a classic bureaucracy. So I called a meeting on the 20th of May in 98, and we got the whole of the small industry together who operate these aircraft, and we said, this was the publicity which it went out, air taxi standards, charter or RPT. For aircraft with less than 10 passenger seats, this is generally based on the US Federal Aviation's air taxi standard, and we said that we wanted to go to one standard for these aircraft. Industry representatives were fundamentally opposed to the proposal for one standard common approach. Now, that's the answer, because what happened, the mates network got into power. You can imagine this, that we've got a number of small airline operators who operate these chieftains, and they're considered to be an airline. And they believe, because of the paperwork that they allegedly comply with, that they're a higher standard than charter. At the meeting, we had the charter operators there too, and we said, we're going to move to one standard, and that will remove all of this ridiculous, unnecessary paperwork that a small operator will reduce safety by doing because you misallocate safety dollars. You end up, as the Sydney Morning Herald said this morning, with your engineer spending 50% of the time doing paperwork and 50% of the time doing surveillance of the engineers who are working on the aircraft. That's no good. Well, it failed because the mates network got in, and the guys who already had these scheduled service licences, they stopped it from changing. And without a strong minister, we got nowhere. The interesting thing was, when I spoke to one of these guys, a person in an eastern state, I said, well, how do you comply with this incredible paperwork? Because I've spoken to Kim Brown. He said, oh, I don't do it. I have a dispensation. And see, that's how the mate system works. Understand this. You have regulations that if someone falls out with you like Kim Brown, you thump him all the time with them. But if the person's a mate, or as Kazza would say, responsible, because they get on with us, will you give them concessions and favours and dispensations? When I became chairman, I found that Qantas and Ansett had this huge list of dispensations. I said, well, I want a copy of them. They've never been in front of Parliament. Parliament sets the safety regulations of this country. I couldn't find them. I've never found them to this day. At one stage, AOPA asked for what they were, and they were told very quickly by Kazza that, oh no, Ansett had commercial advantage with the dispensations it had on safety regulations, so they weren't to be told. So you can't even find them through Freedom for Information. So we have a system where the mates network works for the people who cooperate. It doesn't work for the ones who don't. Now, the next point we decided to do was to allocate a substantial amount of our resources to education. And let me just show you this text here, I mightn't be able to find. Here it is. The text here from the Civil Aviation Act 98 says, CASA has the following safety-related functions. Encouraging a greater acceptance by the aviation industry of its obligation to maintain high standards of aviation safety. That's good because safety mainly comes from the industry. And through comprehensive safety education and training programs. Pretty clear. So we decided that we would go ahead and allocate up to a third of our money to safety training. We were planning, I know we got the first stage was to set a manager there who reported straight to our chief executive in charge of this type of training, and it was to be pushed towards the small industry, the small operator who needed this training and assistance. Well, as of yesterday, I rang a number of them. They said, we've never seen it happen. We've never seen anything other than once a year there's a meeting. You can go into Sydney or Adelaide and sit in a meeting and be told about various safety things, but that's for the whole industry. Never has any appreciable amount of money been allocated to where the problem is. Now, most importantly what I did, the greatest breakthrough that I attempted to do was to see if we could assist Whyalla, because in talking to Kim, I accepted everything he said except one thing, and I'll tell you what it was. He'd had an inadvertent accident where a plane was about to land and they'd forgotten to put the gear down. This can happen. But instead of reporting it to CASA, to my organisation, they'd put the plane in the hangar and they were repairing it. That wasn't so bad, but when the CASA inspector went to ask him, why are you repairing this plane, it's been damaged, he wouldn't talk to the CASA inspector. And I said, Kim, why wouldn't you? And he said, well, my solicitor advised me not to. And I said, Kim, you're the chief pilot of this airline. The whole thing works on trust. Take no notice of your solicitor, because you cannot run an airline as a chief pilot if you will not discuss what the safety issues are. And Kim said, you're right, I will. And he did. But presumably he didn't want to talk to the inspector because he thought he wouldn't be treated fairly. Understand, in the USA, you'd get a warning on that, and if you did something like that a second time, you'd get a $500 or a $1,000 fine. You don't hear because there's no proper enforcement system. Well, what I did was I said, how can we find out, first of all, if Whyalla Airlines are being treated vindictively, and how can we assist this operator? Because he seems very genuine, seems very hardworking. He obviously loves aviation. We don't want him to be another Monarch or Seaview. So I contacted Qantas. I said, Qantas, he's an on-carrier for you. You must be interested. I said, would you provide one of your top safety people to go and talk to Kim Brown? I rang Kim up and he said, I'd be delighted. He said, no, that would be fantastic, which showed me he wasn't dishonest. If he was happy to have CASA organise some people from outside to come and give him advice. So Doug Gillies, who's in charge of safety at Qantas, said immediately, we will nominate Tony Matthews. Tony Matthews is an airline pilot and he's the CEO of Eastern Airlines. I spoke to Tony Matthews, he said, I'd be delighted to be involved. Then we decided to pick the editor-in-chief of Australian Flying Magazine, Paul Phelan, airline pilot, commercial pilot, highly skilled. We contacted him. Yes, he would be involved. CASA would pay all the costs. CASA would pay the airfares and an honorarium for these people. We also got in touch with an ex-RAAF training instructor, squadron leader from Brisbane, and he said he would be involved. The dates were set, the 3rd, 4th and 5th of February, my notes show, Kim. All going to happen. But at the last moment, I was told, no, you can't do this, Dick. Suddenly the bureaucracy works, and anyone who's ever worked for a large bureaucracy, you can't do it. It's not due process. You can only send CASA people. I said, this is ridiculous. Look what happens when we send CASA people. We end up with these accidents. We never solve the problem. So I know I had to ring Kim and say, Kim, I'm sorry, it's not happening. And it never went ahead, stopped completely. Now, the third thing we were going to do was to introduce a proper enforcement system. Pretty simple. We set up with this paper, it's called Discussion Paper, A New Approach to Enforcement. It mentioned that we were going to move to a system called administrative fines, which of course what works in just about everything else in Australia. And at the very end we said here that once the consultation was finished, that the new enforcement system would be implemented by the 1st of September of 98. And what it was going to do was to simply, quite simple, say that initially if you make a mistake you'll be counselled and helped. If you then take no notice, you will be fined. The fine might be $100, $200, $500. You can then go to court, just like a road fine. You can go to court and say, I'm not going to pay. These people have been vindictive to me. And the judge will make a decision. If we'd given Kim Brahm a fine of $500 because he didn't add up, his pilot didn't add up the weight and balance sheet correctly, but it had no effect on safety, the judge would throw it out, of course, or the magistrate. So no one would try and do that, come on. Well, the enforcement system never went ahead. By the way, what was part of it was an indemnity, because in the United States and other countries where they have enforcement systems, which are like anything else, what became apparent is that you need pilots to put themselves in. You need pilots who will fill out a safety report when they've made an error. Now, of course, they're not going to do that if they are going to be fined. So part of the enforcement system was to take straight from the Canadian and US system, which is an indemnity. And it said, the heading here, indemnity. In effect, if you haven't made an intentional or deliberate error, if you've made a mistake, if you report it with a civil aviation incident report, it's a confidential incident report, and then CASA goes to fine you, you can produce the report. You only have to produce it then, and it's an indemnity. Now, pretty good system, and it at least means we can bring in a fining system. Well, the first thing that happened was BASI. First of all, I knew the airlines didn't want it, because at the Senate inquiry before that, I'd been chairman in 1991, and I'd made one attempt to bring in a fair enforcement system. And I'll just read this out to you. This is the head of safety at Qantas, Mr. Lewis. It is my belief that the instant you have a punitive issue, where if someone volunteers information and says, yes, I forgot to fasten the last bolt, and it's my fault, and then you get hit with a $500 fine, he was referring to my $500 fines, they are not going to tell you that they did not fasten the bolt. John Sharp says, how often does anybody get hit with a $500 fine, to use your words? Mr. Lewis from Qantas. What we're saying is that it was proposed. Mr. Sharp, I've never ever heard of it happening within Qantas, of anyone being fined by CASA, because no one had ever been fined, or even today has ever been fined by CASA. Now, later on it goes to say that, in fact, Qantas stopped the enforcement system from coming in, because if you're a large airline, you never get fined. You never get any punitive action taken against you in this country, because for that to happen, you'd have to have an independent regulator and investigator, and we don't. So they never get fined. In the United States, the airlines get fined $1, $2, $3 million for major safety breaches. As you know, if you pollute in this country, you'll be fined. If you break the trade practices rules, you'll be fined. But of course, in Australia, that doesn't happen at all. So what happened with the enforcement system was that it never went ahead, because BASI said to me, I spoke to Rob Lee at BASI, no, we won't support the indemnity. We won't accept a care report that's going to be used as indemnity. And I said, why not? And he said, oh, we'd get too many of them. And I said, Rob, you're only going to get them when someone's breaking the law. Don't you want to know if a pilot is breaking the law? Oh, no, we won't support that. He said, over in the USA they have it, and they get far too many reports. Now, that was the logic, so it didn't get brought in, and as I told you, the airlines put pressure on, and they're still talking about it. I wrote to the minister and said, when's it coming in? And he said, oh, they're having further consultation and so forth. But unless you have someone very tough who says, this is the way to go. If I drive out of here today and I turn left when it says turn right, policeman's likely to pull me over and give me a fine. If I take off in my plane and turn left instead of right, there's no fining system. Well, of course, they'll all ring up the newspaper and be on the front page of the Adelaide Advertiser. But otherwise, there's no fining system, other than they can go to the Department of Public Prosecutions, and that takes 2 years for a fining system, or they can lift my AOC, which is what they did, or lift Kim's certificate. Can you imagine a system where there's nothing in between doing nothing and taking away someone's livelihood? It's really open to mateship, to cronyism. You do the right thing by us, mate, we won't lift your certificate. It was well known that Kim Brahm, he stood up to them. And so what I'm saying is I don't have any evidence that he's any worse than many operators like that. The difference was he stood up to my people. Now, instead of us bringing in, CASA bringing in enforcement system, we didn't. Very, very sad. So the thing that I'm saying now is that those three major changes we couldn't bring in, but we had the success with one, and that was that we wanted to inform the public of the different levels of safety, because small planes are not required to comply with the regulations of larger planes. It's actually affordable safety. Now, I know there's a lot of people here from the media who say Dick Smith introduced affordable safety, or it's a concept of Dick Smith's. It isn't. Affordable safety is the fact that aircraft of different sizes have quite different safety standards because it's the passenger who pays for the level of safety. It's been there for time immemorial. It's incredibly important you tell people. So we produced a brochure. I must tell you that I basically wrote most of the brochure. It wasn't my idea. The Morris Inquiry, Peter Morris Inquiry in Parliament, said after the Seaview accident that Australians should be told what the different levels of safety are. It says aviation safety information for passengers flying on scheduled air services. If you open it up, it's very clear. By the way, the present minister always, he wants consensus. When we sent it to the airlines, they just said no way. They don't want anyone to know that there's different levels of safety. And it shows here the chieftain. It gives the codes with ANSET and Qantas, PAG for a chieftain. Then it shows the planes that Kendall fly, it shows the planes that Qantas fly, and it says very clearly in the brochure, when there's an alternative, to pick the aircraft which complies with a higher safety standard. Well, that brochure, we did about 20,000, but it sort of disappeared off the face of the earth. I got my staff to ring the CASA office here in Adelaide and ask for a copy of the brochure. Got switched from place to place, and finally got told, oh, we don't think it's printed yet. Then suggested that we look on the report on the CASA website, and it had things like, for passengers, is your luggage safe? But it didn't mention the safety brochure, which taught you which plane you could go on for a higher level of safety. Now, the reason it didn't do that is because when you have a system where CASA and the safety regulator are so close to the airlines that they all work together, you're going down a very dangerous path. Because it worked very well when we had an economically regulated environment. Qantas and the safety regulator, Department of Aviation, were the same. Whenever they wanted to spend more money on safety, they dialed up another airfare and they went to the airfares tribunal, they put up the airfare. 10 years ago, the Labor Party decided to economically deregulate the airlines. So now there's enormous pressure to save money. That's when you then need a ruggedly independent regulator. And very quickly, I'm going over time, I want to mention how I failed at those reforms, and really I have to put it all back to John Anderson. And people say, Dick, you've obviously had a falling out with John Anderson. I haven't. He's the most delightful bloke I've ever met. I never, ever had a meeting with him alone. I could never get past his minders or sit there with a minder. The best I ever got was John Sharper managed to arrange a meal with us in a crowded restaurant. But I never, ever could see my minister as chairman of the Civil Aviation Safety Authority to tell him how he was being snowed by his department and how he had serious problems. It's interesting because I've worked as chairman of CASA, or CAA, with people like Kim Beazley as minister, Gareth Evans, Bob Collins, John Sharp, I think for a short time, Mark Vail, had no problems with any of them, all spent time with them, and we used to laugh how the bureaucracy will stop anything from happening. Can we get 20% of the changes through? Wouldn't that be great? That'll be great for Australia. I used to sit with Mark Vail in his kitchen at Taree, and we'd discuss what the dreams were, all of these points which he all supported. When John Anderson became minister, the whole board were ordered down to see John, and we sat there with all his minders, and he gave us two instructions. I don't want Cheryl Curnow asking me questions in Parliament, and I don't want to be in the news. And I said, Minister, look, can you imagine waterfront reform or gun law reform without being in the news? We have tremendous problems. We will be in the news while we fix them. Now, he never came up to speed. It's not as if he has a different opinion. That wouldn't be too bad. But he never really spent the time on aviation. And so his attitude was, what are my advisers saying? His advisers are saying to him all the time, do nothing, don't go ahead with the reform, which stopped when he became minister. Everything's okay. Just before I resigned as chairman, the Ski Hill report came out. It's this great big thick one, and it was the report of the aquatic air disaster in Sydney, when a little float plane, the pilot obviously hadn't been properly trained by the look of it, turned in a narrow valley downwind and killed everyone. But when the report came out, it showed incredible things. The worst one of the lot was that we managed to ground that particular operator, which was necessary, and about a week later the operator started flying again. And as a board, we said, why was this allowed? We then found out by reading the Ski Hill report that a senior Qantas manager lobbied on behalf of this shonky operator and got them flying again. We were horrified. We then read the report and realised, well, once again, it's the problem of no proper enforcement system. So I went up, I flew all the way up to Gunnedah, and I thought I'd probably see the minister by himself. I actually had a few minutes before his minder came in, but then his minder came in, and I said to the minister, I'd prepared a press release which has now become quite famous. I'd discuss it with my board, and I said, Minister, this aquatic air report will be a bombshell. It's a complete repeat of Advance, Monarch, Seaview. I said, it shows we haven't got anywhere. And I said, but Minister, I see a great chance of fixing it, because most of the problems during the aquatic air time of problems of non-compliance and no enforcement happened when Laurie Brereton's board was in. And I said, then the final crash happened when your board was there. I said, but here is the great chance of fixing it, because Labor won't be able to attack you. Read the report, they were there. But I didn't realise, I was naive. The minister's office thought quite differently. They obviously thought, oh, if both governments were involved, we can put the lid on it. And that's what they did. They put the lid on it. And I'm very happy to give anyone, journalists, the press release that I took, which said things like, I'll read from it, you can have a copy of it. It said things like, CASA board adopts hands-on activist approach. The board of Australia's aviation regulator and watchdog CASA has resolved to take a more hands-on approach in order to prevent the continuation of a culture of compliant cronyism within the organisation. The chairman, Dick Smith, outlined the board's decision as he released a report of the inquiry into SOFOF. Mr. Smith also announced that CASA for the first time would issue fines for safety infractions. That's a pretty daring thing, isn't it? And would be seeking government approval for a significant increase in the level of fines. Currently, the maximum fine CASA can impose is $500. And by the way, we've never imposed one, but we're going to put it up. It says here, compared with fines of more than $200,000, which can be imposed by the US regulator, the Federal Aviation Authority. And we said here, unfortunately, Mr. Smith said CASA had to learn from the two thorough and searching internal examinations. Unfortunately, they show CASA has not succeeding in becoming the strong, independent industry regulator protecting the fair-paying passengers that the Australian people can expect. Now, you would think that a minister would think, well, gee, if the board's prepared to be hands-on and prepared to be tougher, that's pretty good. No, he actually, fortunately for me, so they couldn't deny it, his really bright minder sent me a note saying, Dick, here is what the minister wants in the new press release. You can have a copy of that. Then rewrote the press release and left out anything about being tough or having any problems or anything. Well, I only lasted 3 weeks after that. I decided I was going to get out, and I basically got out because I wasn't going to be in a position where I would be held accountable by the people of Australia when I had no power to fix the problems. We've now moved on. We have this very unfortunate Whyalla crash. and we don't know what the answer is. I can tell you, you will not get the answer from BASI, the Bureau of Air Safety Investigation. It changed its name. I objected to the fact that they'd been captured by the airlines, so what they did was they had a review which didn't look into my claims, removed the esteemed director of BASI, Rob Lee, has been moved aside in another room, I understand, put a new director on who I don't know who it is, and changed the name of the organisation. Great stuff from government, isn't it? Great stuff from government. Now, I can tell you now, what you should be doing is pushing to have an independent investigator look into the Whyalla Air accident. It will be the only way Kim will get a fair hearing, because don't think for a second that BASI or the ATSB is independent. For a start, it comes under the minister and has to protect the minister. That's their job. Or even if you had a particularly brave person in the ATSB, and there are good people there, like there are good people in CASA, they're a typical cross-section of the community. If you came up and you had something in your report about Whyalla that criticised the government, how would your career go in future? You work for the department under the minister. And just very quickly, I called for the NTSB to come in. The National Transport Safety Board, it doesn't report to anyone. The members are elected by the President of the USA. They're not fools. It reports to nobody. It's like the judiciary. It's completely separate. The other interesting thing is, when BASI finishes one of these reports, it sends the report to interested parties. Talk about a corrupt system. They wrote a report about the Class G airspace, and about a quarter of it was rubbishing me. This is an airspace trial we did. So then they sent it to me before it's released for me to comment. And obviously the inference was, mate, look, toe the line and do the right thing and it'll be fixed up. I understand that the report, and I don't know if this is true, you can find out, into the Bangkok accident at the moment is with Qantas. They are an interested party. They are looking at it. Now, let's look at the National Transport Safety Board. When the first draft report is done, it is released at a public hearing. No one sees it first. And then, of course, people who are interested can make adjustments, can point out if the investigator has been wrong. So I've gone over my time a bit, but basically what I want to say is that we can be the leaders in the world in aviation. In flying training, we can bring people from all around the world. We already have a very good airline system, which needs a very strong independent regulator and investigator if it's going to maintain its safety standards. We can only do that with a committed government and a committed minister who comes up to speed on aviation. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dick Smith.
I've given him a Tandy microphone. I'll go and get a good Dick Smith one.
I'll use this one. Now, questions from the media. Would you remember, please, to give your name and organisation before you ask your question? And this time, would you all go to the central point to ask your question? Thanks very much.
No questions? You've all been such a good audience. If we can get someone to hand around some of these very rare matches. There's about one per table, I'm afraid. So there you are.
Come on, please, media, leap.
Mr. Smith, Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail, a double barrel one. Can you give us an estimate how many small airlines are not complying with regulations at the moment for whatever reason? And also, if you're talking about different levels of safety between big airlines and small airlines, isn't there an equity issue where rich people can fly in safety, poor people fly by the seat of their pants?
Well, first of all, I'll answer the second one first. Well, there might be, so what you'd have to do is cross-subsidise and lower the safety of the large airlines, take money from safety, which is in the ticket cost of a fare on a large airline, and move it to the small ones. That's a government decision. You could do that. But I don't know if Australians would be that happy having less money and a lowering in safety of the large airlines. And that's what would have to happen. Finite amount of money, you're just shifting the resources around. The first question, oh yes, what percentage don't comply? I'll tell you now, it's simply impossible for a small airline running these single pilot, nine passenger aircraft to comply with the existing regulations. So you could say none of them do. Now, what percentage is safe? 95% are very safe. Going in these small planes is safer than going by road. I once had a figure which showed that a small aircraft like Whaler Airlines, if it's maintaining the safety standards, statistically is about 10 times safer than going by road. If you go in a medium-sized aircraft, it's about 60 times safer. And if you go in a jet airline, it's 300 times safer. That's exposure per passenger kilometre. So air is still safer than going by road, but there are very large differences in safety. And just very quickly, let me explain to you that a small aeroplane like a Chieftain is not certified, does not have to be able to fly on one engine if the other engine fails. And so there are circumstances, if you took off and it was a hot day and you were at gross weight and you didn't have the landing gear up when the engine failed, that you have to come down. It's like a single engine aircraft. Once you move up to a 19 passenger aircraft or so, they are certified to fly at all times on one engine. There's only one pilot in a single pilot 9-passenger machine. It's pretty obvious that if the pilot had some medical incapacitation, you're not in a great position as a passenger. Whereas if there's two pilots, a lot better. There are no fire extinguishers. In a typical airline aircraft, it has two complete fire extinguisher systems per engine. And it's powered by aviation turbine fuel, which doesn't burn as much. In a Chieftain, there's no fire extinguisher in the engine at all. And so they are the different safety standards which have been forced on us by the reality of the fact that we don't cross-subsidise between large airlines and small ones. If a government wanted to do that, it could do it. At the moment, regulators and governments won't even admit to it. They don't want to tell anyone what the truth is. I would rather tell the truth and let people make up their own mind. Maybe we'd end up in a situation where we did cross-subsidise. Yes? I'm happy to answer any questions about Dick Smith Foods.
Mignon Laurenti, formerly ABC. Dick Smith, were you implying, or do you think, that the Whyalla crash could have been caused by overloading?
No, I wasn't. Now, I've got no idea what the Whyalla crash was caused by, but you'll never... If BASI or the ATSB write one of these reports, forget about it, because they're just completely useless. They'll say, you need to do more paperwork. Whyalla needs to do more paperwork. That's what the answer will be, because fundamentally, if you read these reports, that's basically what it talks about. But if Whyalla did less paperwork and could spend more money, and I checked this with Kim just when we were talking just before the lunch, I said, if you did less paperwork, could you spend more money on training of pilots? And he said, yes. And my case rests. To put the most incredible amount of bureaucratic mumbo-jumbo on a small operator simply means they are less safe and we end up with more accidents. You have to have operators that are profitable for them to have the correct safety ethos to employ the better people who will be able to maintain the level of safety. You only do that by removing any cost which is not effective safety-wise. There was a gentleman who... Sorry.
Something close to your heart, made in Australia, and I greatly admire what you do on that behalf. Now, in South Australia, in the past 10 to 15 years, we have actually lost dozens and dozens of manufacturing plants, and mainly offshore, not always, and the latest casualty is the largest of all manufacturers of shoes, Clark Shoes, which will have its closing down sale, sadly, ending this Friday. Now, in view of this, the drift offshore, and in view of government policies, how pessimistic are you about the future of we Australians actually buying Australian goods?
Yeah. Well, I'm very pessimistic. I can't understand. See, the thing I can't understand is I believe in a free market, and we've actually done very well out of a free market in Australia in very many ways. But I don't understand that a free market means selling off all of your famous businesses. And that's what we've done. We grow the best food in the world, and I want to mention food, because shoes is a difficult one. I'm not sure if we are the experts at making shoes at good value for money. There are some things countries do well, and there are some things you don't do that well, so you specialise. My problem is that when it comes to food, we grow the best food on earth. We have the most efficient farmers on earth, but go to a supermarket and try and buy some Australian asparagus. You'll find it's John West and it comes from America. What's happened with globalisation when these companies have come in and taken over all of our famous Aussie brands, and you only have to look on the back of a packet of our famous Dickhead matches, it says here, brands such as Vegemite, Aeroplane Jelly, Arnott's, Speedo and now Redhead Matches are in overseas hands. That's just a start. Virtually every famous brand from Arnott's Biscuits to Edgell's to Vegemite has now been sold off overseas. And that means all the wealth created goes overseas. Now, how do we fight back? First of all, we have to tell our politicians that we are concerned. Most of the politicians say to me, no one cares really if it's Aussie made or not. The Aussie made campaign doesn't work. It didn't work because it was hijacked by the foreign companies. 80% of the Aussie made logo holders, I understand, are foreign companies. Now, Australians are not stupid. We like Australian made. That's important. But Australian made and Australian owned is even better because the profits and wealth creation stays here. At the moment, something like $100 million a day goes out of Australia, more than comes in our trade, and on our monetary deficiency and efficiencies, and 80% of that $100 million a day is in dividends and interest payments on borrowings. And so you can see the problem. Now, luckily, there's this enormous groundswell of opinion because we can fix it. We can fix it ourselves by openly supporting the home team. And it's just saying, my motto here is as Australian as you can get, and this is really a branding exercise, where I'm charging a licence fee of 7.5%, doing all the hard work to find out that we can make it as Australian as you can get, and that's really difficult. To get a peanut butter manufacturer that's Australian owned was hard. A biscuit manufacturer was even harder. There's only one left. Players, quite extraordinary. Luckily, you have Vierenberg, Jam here, and it's good that Qantas support them, one of the very few Aussie companies that are left. So basically what I'm saying is support Aussie made and Aussie owned to taxes in providing the dole to these people who have lost their jobs, and the only difference would be the profits that go to Aldi in Germany, owned by the eighth most wealthiest family on earth, who are trying to make themselves the seventh most wealthiest family. See, we are crawling. We go around the world, our politicians, crawling for people to come in here. My attitude is if they are going to take risk, I think foreign investment is fantastic. And you've had some great examples here in South Australia. If people are going to come and take risk, employ Australians, that's wonderful. If they're going to come to our country, buy an existing famous brand or existing business, sack 20% of the staff, take all the profits back to the USA and then pay no tax here because 50% of foreign companies pay no tax at all, well, we don't want them and we should tell them that.
Yes, Mr. Smith. Mark Steen from The Advertiser. Sorry to take you back to Waiala. You said on a number of occasions that Waiala Airlines should have been grounded before the crash, and you said also that it should be grounded since the crash. Do you stand by that, or do you think you should wait for the ATSB report?
Well, it's very difficult because I don't know what the facts are, but I do know at the time that CASA made some decisions in relation to Waiala Airlines. And the difficulty I've got at the moment, I've spoken to Kim and Chris, and they're utterly convinced that they're extremely safe and all the rest of it. I don't have that information, but I'm very concerned. And the reason I called for the airline to be grounded is that when it comes to who you're going to give the benefit of the doubt, I really believe you've got to give it to the travelling public. And that's very tough on Waiala Airlines, but they haven't, and you haven't read these reports. And if an airline doesn't have enough money because of outside pressures or inside pressures to be able to do the additional amount of training that is required and spend the additional amount on safety, well, you have to be very careful about allowing it to keep flying. And I want to mention something here about this knee-jerk reaction of asking for legislation to put in life jackets. Now, I cannot work out why any airline or any pilot would fly over water continuously without life jackets. The international regulations which are set for air safety, and they're pretty well international, set a minimum standard. They don't try and spoon-feed people. It's impossible to. I checked up after the Whyalla crash to when there was a call for more legislation. This is what Bazzy will say, more regulations. And so I checked up with the equivalent operators up in Queensland, and they all carry life jackets. They said, come off it, we wouldn't operate without life jackets. Our pilots are over the water all the time. And so that's the type of thing you've got to look into. It's not the regulation, it's does the company have the experience, the management expertise, and the money to be able to put life jackets in the aircraft. I don't know if Kim or Chris want to answer why they didn't have life jackets, which one of those it was.
Mr. Smith, I'd like Peter Gerst from Sunday Mail, I would like as a guest here at this function to offer my condolences to the Brougham family and to Whyalla Airlines and to all those who were killed on that dreadful crash, which I haven't heard forthcoming from the guest speaker. However, I have a question in several parts. As someone who lost both his parents in an airplane accident in 1982 and is a bereaved son, the last thing that I would have wanted to have heard was a former public servant say within hours of that plane crashing, nya, 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 I told you so. Now, how can you explain that grotesque insensitivity of your comments so soon after the crash?
Right, well, first of all, you're misquoting me, but I didn't want another unnecessary accident and people to die. As simple as that. And I was chairman at the time when Aquatic Air crashed because they had been grounded, and without our board knowing, it's all in the report, a CASA inspector, because of the mates network, had got them flying again, and within, I think it was 12 days, they crashed and killed people. Now, that's what I'm concerned about. Now, what do you do? Do I sit there and say, look, I'm concerned and I know that there are problems, but I'll say nothing. We'll wait for Bazzy to come out with another one of these reports in 8 months' time. That'll say, you need to do more paperwork.
You had left CASA. You were a private citizen. And you made what I perceive, and many other people perceive, as remarks, the timing of which were extremely suspect and insensitive.
Secondly, but hold on, the airline wasn't grounded. It was going to fly again. It was reported that it would be flying within 2 days.
I'm speaking of the timing of your remarks so soon after the crash.
Well, I'm sorry. I understood. I didn't make the remarks until I was told that the aeroplane could be flying this afternoon. The company could be flying this afternoon. That greatly concerned me because I know that we don't have a competent safety regulator. Now, most people here would expect the safety regulator would be competent and it could make that decision. I can assure you there is ample evidence, I've only gone through 10% of it, that that's not so. We don't have an independent, competent safety regulator. You can imagine my position where our board had been right through this with Whyalla Airlines. We were very concerned that they would be another Monarch or Seaview or Whyalla. Or Monarch, Seaview, or Advance, and the plane crashes. Now, we don't know why it crashed. It then gets reported that there are no life jackets on board the aircraft. It was reported almost immediately. Well, come on. I mean, doesn't that signify something to you?
Of course. But
Peter, keep it to questions, would you, please?
Sorry?
Would you keep it to questions,
yes,
please?
Yes, okay. Yeah. My second question is with regard to Dick Smith Foods, which I applaud, although your own company, Dick Smith Electronics, which you sold to Woolworths, which is an Australian company, you can go into any Dick Smith Electronics store and have to look very, very hard to find anything at all made in Australia. Now, how do you explain this? Do you think it's hypocritical? And secondly, are you marketing yourself as a professional Australian,
bearing in mind your name and graven image appears on your every product, or are you marketing Australian goods? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I thought I'd covered the issue of Dick Smith. You do what you're good at. We don't happen, unless I've been misled, we don't happen to make transistors and video recorders and the things that Dick Smith sell. We're not good at that. But we're fantastic at food. And so I believe you do what you're good at. I've just said I'm totally for a totally free market. I'm not for putting restrictions on. We don't. The products that you see in Dick Smith Electronics are not things we're good at. If we were good at, Dick Smith Electronics would buy them here. And so when it comes to food, I just happen to believe that's what we're good at. So I can understand a situation where at the moment 85% of products in a typical supermarket trolley are imported or overseas owned. Now that's a food in a supermarket trolley. I can understand 80% of our electronics manufacturers being overseas owned, because that's what other countries excel at. But I would think to balance that, 80% of our food companies would be Aussie-owned. And so that's my answer to it. I'm basically saying, do what you're good at. I have imported a lot of product from overseas, but I want to export, or at least get Australians to buy products from Aussie-owned companies and Aussie farmers. And just about the name, by the way. Look, I've done very well out of this country. I know you're a cynical journalist, and you won't probably accept this, but if I wanted to make more money, I'd stick to electronics, I can assure you. Food is the lowest margin item. You know, Woolworths make 1.2 cents in the dollar or something like that. But I'm a typical Australian. I live hugging the coast, but I identify with the country, with the bush. And the country people are really having it hard at the moment, and we can solve that problem by buying from them. And when I see that the farmers in the Lachlan Valley have pulled up all their asparagus because an American company took over Edgell's and closed the cannery down, and our asparagus now comes from Canada, I naturally want to get the farmers growing again so we can sell asparagus under our own brand. And if the way I do that is by putting Dick Smith on it, well, that's fantastic. Gives me great satisfaction.
Avanel Grace from MagnaCare. We're a small company who designs, manufactures and markets our own medical equipment here. And I congratulate you on what you've done. And I also think if a few more people stood up and said, nah, 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 when there's trouble, we might get more results. Congratulations, Dick.
Thank you.
Any more questions, please?
One more here. I'm not a journalist, but I was curious your answer to a previous question, which you implied that the onus should be on the aircraft operator to decide whether it was appropriate or not to carry life vests. The fact is the regulations, Wyalur Airlines, as far as I know, were fully in compliance with the regulations. They weren't required to carry life vests, and presumably there are very good reasons for that. I wonder if you could comment on whether you think it should be up to the operator to assess when it is reasonable or not to act over and above what the regulatory requirements are.
Yes. See, it goes back that safety regulations are set around the world at a minimum safety standard, and virtually everyone does extra. If you think that Qantas and Ansett have such good safety records, and despite what you're reading all the time, I travel with Qantas all the time, and they are a very safe airline. Yes, they've got some problems at the moment that I believe an independent regulator would help them with, but Qantas spend tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, above the minimum safety requirement. And if you think that aviation businesses just simply do the minimum requirement, I can tell you aviation would be nowhere near as safe as it can be. Now, why is the regulation like that? I would imagine it's designed because most aircraft in that category don't fly over water continuously. It's not designed for a scheduled service, that category. It's an air taxi operator, and a flight over water would be very occasional. Now, yes, you could write a thing that says, however, no, life jackets are not required. However, if you're going to fly over water more than 60% of the time or 10% of the time, you need life jackets. No doubt someone will do that. I can tell you it won't stop any planes crashing. You've really got to have that safety ethos and a lot of common sense to say, this is where I'm going to spend my money.
Leon Bignall from the ABC. These wholesale changes that you're talking about within the aviation, the way we look at safety and everything in this country, you haven't been able to do it from within CASA, and to this stage you haven't been able to do it outside of that either. How realistic do you think it is, and how long will you maintain the fight?
Yes, believe it or not, after I left, resigned from CASA, I turned off for 12 months because I thought surely they'll bring in some of the changes. When I found they hadn't, everything had been stopped. That really concerned me. And I'm told by other people, Dick, you won't fix anything until there is a major catastrophe. Dick, that's how these things work. And if you look in other countries, and basically every fundamental change in safety has come from lots of people dying, 200 or 300 people dying in accidents. Look at the safety regulations. The terminal collision avoidance system came because a 747 ran in and killed 400 people, ran into the ground. The TCAS, which is the device, a black box that tells where other aircraft are, only came in as a requirement because, once again, hundreds of people died. Now, what I'm saying to you here, we've got the ears of the media, that we've really got to try and do something about it before anyone dies. And I can assure you, to go down a path where you have an economically deregulated industry that's cutting each other's throat and trying to save every dollar they can, and I'm talking about the major airlines, but without a truly independent regulator and safety investigator, well, we're experimenting in a way that no other nation has ever experimented before.
And John Anderson's position as Transport Minister, do you think he should continue there?
Well, if he came up to speed, he's just got to spend, I can't believe, maybe he doesn't want that job and they should put another minister on. I've never been able to get one sentence or one paragraph where he's said what his vision is for aviation. If anyone's ever managed to get anything, I've never seen that. And I would say in that case he's either too busy or it's not the job that's suited to him, and they should very quickly get a minister. We're going through a very serious time. And I've often said you need someone like Peter Reith as Minister for Aviation, and you need someone like Alan Fells in charge of safety regulation. Then we're going to get somewhere.
Just time for perhaps two more, but very quick questions, please. We're running out of time.
Mr. Smith, my name's Michael Wellborn. I'm an independent consultant, and I've had some dealings with CASA and Mr. Morris, I might add. And I know the federal bureaucracy very well. One a comment and the other a question. My first comment is that my dealings with
question,
CASA...
question, please, no comment. Could I have your question
is, in my dealings with CASA, I met a lot of people in middle management, and I stress that, who were passionate about safety. Absolutely passionate. And it struck me, in view of your remarks, most of which resonate with me very well, perhaps there's a case for taking air safety right out of the political system.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And Kim Beazley planned to do that. It's quite interesting. See, the problem with CASA is you can't be half pregnant. And what they did was, it used to be a government department totally funded by government. And they started to fund it by a fuel tax. And the plan of Kim Beazley, it'd take me a second to find the documentation, but was to put a ticket levy, the same as New Zealand, of $2 on every ticket. And it would be completely out of government. It would be funded by people who fly. And that is the way to go, because the minute you have it in a situation where it gets about $40 million from the taxpayer, that means that all of the pressure groups, first of all, that $40 million goes straight to the bottom lines of the two airlines. It just goes straight to their profit. It's a government subsidy to the two airlines, because they'd otherwise be paying for it. If you follow the New Zealand system and put a $2 quite clear safety regulation tax or amount, they call it a levy, on the air ticket, and it was funded completely by those who fly, suddenly the bureaucracy, who knows at the moment, and there's a cutting here somewhere, so every time there's an accident, what BASI says, the ATSB says, is they need more staff, and CASA needs more staff. And if you read these reports, you think the last thing they need is more staff, because all they do is write more letters and never do anything. So already there's an article in the paper from John Anderson saying they're putting more staff on, because The bureaucracy knows the only way of getting more stuff and more money is to, when there's an accident, is beating it up in the media. If you go to a system where the money comes from $2 an air ticket, it's a very good incentive, because if you have a crash and less people fly, there's less money for the safety regulator. If aviation is encouraged because it's safe and it's not too expensive, there are more $2 coming in and the regulator has more money. So there is no doubt that Kim Beazley's idea and Paul Keating's idea of 91, 92, to take it off the government budget and have it self-funding, will start to solve the problem completely. You would think a coalition government would do that. One of the things I didn't cover, one of our reforms of our board was to bring in this charging system with the $2 ticket levy, and John Anderson, they probably wouldn't even understand it today.
Last question.
Thank you, good afternoon. My name is Pete Smith. No relative, no conflict of interest, no back payment. I don't even buy his bloody peanut butter. But I might get around to it.
I'm going to present you with a jar of peanut butter now. I wanted to know who I'm going to present it to.
How do you beat him? The question that I have is that constantly throughout your, presentation to us this afternoon, you've talked of CASA, CASA, CASA. I should have introduced myself as nobody other than a passenger in Australia today. Nobody other than a passenger. And I think that we passengers, when we hear criticism such as your own, are not critical of you, but more tiresome of the criticism of this faceless bureaucracy. CASA is made up of many thousands of people, and I'm wondering whether or not today you are branding them all the same, or whether there is a level or a group or a small number of influential people, someone like Philby, McLean and Burgess, who, if you like, have the influence in the old days of MI5, who are really the people that you are concerning yourself with and who are really holding up reforms in aviation, and are you prepared to name them?
You must have misheard me. Did I not say there are some very good people in CASA and Air Services?
Oh, yes, I did. I wondered, however, who are the real people?
No, it's not people. It's the system. It's not people. It's the system. That you have a safety investigator which has to protect the minister, so they'll protect the minister, and even the ones who don't want to won't have a career unless they do. So it's the system is wrong. It should be independent. When it comes to CASA, it's so completely politically controlled that it's very highly unionised. The airlines are very powerful. So it just needs some lateral thinking. And I gave you an example of just four things of about 30 reforms we're bringing in. We didn't succeed with any of them. And until you really get, it goes back to the politician, a minister who's got probably better ideas than I have, more ability than I have, I failed, that he or she will then make the changes and will start to solve the problems. Otherwise, if we go down the track to a serious accident and then you have a Royal Commission that solves the problems, well, that's ridiculous. Australia doesn't need that and doesn't deserve it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peanut
butter.
Before you go, I'd like to take our good wishes from Australian... In fact, Coonawarra, Cabernet Sauvignon from 1993. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I won't drink this before I get in the air this afternoon.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Is that okay?
Ladies and gentlemen, if I can just have your attention before you start talking, I would like to tell you a few things. First of all, today's luncheon has been televised by the ABC and will be screened tonight. I believe at 11:30, Gillian Attrell, are you around? Can you help me? Time, 11:30? I believe that's correct. So, 11:15. Okay, 11:15 tonight on the ABC. I can't miss this opportunity to tell you, as the Executive Director of the Variety Club, that it was Dick Smith who invented the Variety Club bash. And we owe an awful lot to Dick, because the bash has netted $40 million for the children of Australia, around Australia. And one day, I keep writing to Dick, one day I'm going to get him on the South Australian bash. One day, Dick, you're going to fly in. Rightio. Also, out the front, Mandy Jane Giannopoulos from Arts SA asked me to ask you if you'd like to pick up a copy of the Arts SA newspaper to have a look at the new precinct and everything that's happening on Arts SA in Hindley Street. So pick up a copy. It's a nice publication as you leave today. With us also is Steve Larkin, who is the new Bureau Chief of AAP and a new member of the Press Club Committee. Steve, come on up and draw the raffle for us and bring the raffle barrel when you come. I left it on the table. Would you please welcome Steve, new Bureau Chief of AAP. Okay, now just adding to our raffle items, the hotel, the Novotel where we are here today, came in and said to me, a night's accommodation at the Novotel on Hindley plus a full buffet breakfast at Ollie's Brasserie as the number one ticket. Say that again? And a girl of your choice. We'll see if we can arrange it. Martin Cameron. Okay, Steve, draw it out for that first prize from the Novotel.
Where are you going? This is A68, Wendy Begg. Who's got the night?
Wendy, come up to me afterwards. I can't find the envelope. They were bringing it into me, but come up to me afterwards and I'll give it to you. Okay, Steve, for the media guide, one of the media guides down the front for the press, radio and television guide.
B38, Brad Crouch.
Brad Crouch, Sunday Mail. There you go, Brad. You've got every contact in the Australian media. When I need to know, I'll come and see you, Blossom. There you go. Just right in front of you. No, just right in front of you there. Book. No, just book. He's got his contacts in, I'm sure. Okay, for another copy of the book, thank you, Diana Carroll from Media Monitors.
J20, is it B Barrett, is it?
B Barrett, J20, a green ticket. Copy of the book down the front there. Yes, there we go, thank you. And, of course, you all want this. This is the Footy Show polo shirt from Channel 9. Size large.
J84, A Marshall.
A Marshall, an orange ticket, J84. Who's got that one? Come on, quick. Nobody wants the Footy Show. T-shirt, polo shirt. Is that yours? Isn't it? Okay, come up and get it. It belongs to somebody at the table, does it? Okay. Size large. Walter Rogers, where are you, lovely man? Here he comes. A $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouges Street. Who would like the lovely voucher to go there?
It's I-76, G. Weldon.
G. Weldon, I-76, orange ticket. Here we go, down there, Walter. And also, Walter has another $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street, where you can have some lovely Italian. And who do we have, Steve?
B33, Ian Dobler.
Ian Dobler, B33, a white ticket. There we go, right in front of you, Walter, here. We've got 6 bottles of Gramps Barossa Chardonnay from Orlando Wyndham.
A4, A Burns.
A Burns, yellow. A4, yellow. Just the 6 bottles in the tub there of wine. Thank you. Now we've got Rex's balls, a dozen golf balls that Rex Jory brought into us.
J15.
Pauline Coburn. Are you collecting again or for somebody else?
No, wrong one. Wrong colour.
Oh, sorry, it's a yellow.
Yellow ticket. It's on here. There you go, the golf ball's down there. And we have the pen from Telstra, that beautiful pen from Telstra.
A19, Stan James.
Stan James from the Tizer. The pen. And one more, Steve. The Hahn beer from SA Brewing.
Is I-72 Marlene Powell.
Marlene Powell, I-72, orange ticket. That's the beer from SA Brewing. Where's Marlene? Coming, she's coming. And the last one, Rex bought in a clock from the Advertiser, and who do we have for that one?
A12, Christopher Jelly.
Christopher Jelly, A12, a pink ticket. Up the back, there we go. Would you thank Steve Larkin, the new Bureau Chief of AAP? Don't forget, the next lunch is Wednesday the 2nd of August with Adrian Greenoak, the Creative Director of the International Rose Show. It'll be a lovely lunch. Thank you for your attendance today.